session number 17986, reel 2.
Mr. Marston, reel 2.
General Eisenhower said that all troops would wear American uniforms and all aircraft would fly with a star, American star. And this did happen, other than that the powers that be must have had some influence, because we flew with the roundel. One squadron, then we would receive the detailed briefing by the senior RAF officer, which was that one squadron would take off. The British were doing the Algiers sector, by the way. One squadron would take off before the airfield was captured. The servicing commando would go ashore with the first wave at Algiers, capture the airfield, and we'd be there ready to rearm and refuel us as we landed. We had 90-gallon overload tanks underneath our aeroplane to do the journey. And I think it was the first time they'd been used operationally. As I say, there were four squadrons, and as far as our squadron, there were 12 aircraft and 12 pilots. And then it was announced that the senior Royal Air Force officer, I think it was Group Captain Robinson, decided that he was coming with us, but he hadn't got an aeroplane, so somebody was going to lose their aeroplane. And I got a call, would I go and see Raspberry, my CO? And I thought, yes, it's my aeroplane it's taking. Anyway, when I got there, I was very pleased that Ras said, my job was to escort the group captain and stay with him, and lead, not bother with the squadron, but stay with the group captain. And we were maintaining RT silence, of course, and he was straggling behind at times. The squad were only dots on the horizon, and I was trying to indicate, move up. I didn't like being left on my own at the back. Anyway, nothing happened, and we dropped our overload tanks, and we got to over Algiers round about 8 o'clock on the morning of the 8th of November. Not a lot of action, but we had to land, of course, because we were just purely out of fuel. We found Maison Blanche airfield and we landed, but no servicing commando, though in fact it was still in Vichy French hands. We parked our aeroplanes and wondered what was happening. We did find out afterwards, of course, another cock-up. All the servicing commando's equipment was the first put on the ship, so it was the last off. And we were sat on that airfield all day till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when an armoured car came around the perimeter track and we were all parked. And oh, by the way, I was the first sergeant pilot to land, of course, in fact, because I was escorting the senior officer. And so I was parked right at the end. Nobody to talk to. We parked 100 yards apart, okay, so that we didn't get to, if there was an attack, they couldn't wipe out all the aeroplanes in one do. And so I could only talk to the aeroplane next to me was the one flown by the group captain, and he disappeared. So, you know, I was very lonely. And when this armoured car came round and they started to set up obviously an anti-aircraft gun position just back where I was parked, and there was this great big American filling sandbags, and I thought, well, I walked over and just to say, what part of the States are you from? And I hope this won't offend you, but his reply was, States be buggered, I'm from Burnley. They had stars and stripes on their arms. The next thing that happened the next week, of course, the servicing commando arrived, refuelled us. Very difficult with 4 gallon tanks and tins of petrol and this sort of thing. We all helped by lifting them onto the wings, and they were quite heavy. The next morning, the wing commander, I can't even remember his name now, Dutch Hugo. Sorry, I did go in. Dutch Hugo. Took four of us went with Dutch Hugo to do a... The idea was to do a patrol and see what was happening. We were attacked, still with our wheels down, by 4 foot Wolf 190s, and all four of us were shot down. Unfortunately, two were killed. A great friend of mine, Cowboy Stoddart, he was killed. I managed to get down and belly flop. So did the wing commander. But it was I was taken to a casualty clearing station in Algiers to be sent back to UK. But there wasn't much wrong with me. I was lying on a stretcher in a corridor of a technical college, I think it was. They'd taken over as this casualty clearing station. And
can you describe how you were shot down?
I'd basically got my wheels down. I hadn't got them up. And there were I hadn't time to realise what was happening. The engine was obviously hit and stopped, and I just came down. I was about 100 feet when the engine stopped. Just turned, plopped it straight down in the sand. Of course, it was all very sandy. But I say, going back to...
And this was close to Maison
Blanc. Oh, yes, it was within the airfield perimeter, basically.
And it was on the 8th of November?
The 9th, the next day. I don't think I even recorded it in my logbook, as far as I can remember, but it's... if you read that book, Fighters Over North Africa, it recalls the incident in there, which reminded me of it. But I did... I say I was lying on a stretcher in a corridor, and the next stretcher was an Australian pilot, Charlie Kerville, who was with 43 Fighting Cock Squadron, and he'd been shot down too. But he was like me, with not much wrong with us, so the adjutant of 43 Squadron came to visit Charlie, and we arranged that we'd nip out and we wouldn't report, we'd just kind of go over the wall sort of thing. Everybody had got to go back at least to Gibraltar, and we didn't want to lose our squadrons, so we got this adjutant who had got a vehicle to take us up to Maison Blanche. And we called in a wine shop, and I think we bought a bottle of champagne and a bottle of orange Curacao, never having drunk either. We got back to Maison Blanche, and I'd find that my squadron had moved on. They'd gone up to Beaune. Anyway, the night we had to spend the night in some administrative block. We drank all this stuff, and I was absolutely paralytic. But there was an air raid that night. There were ceilings were coming down and what that, but I couldn't have cared less. The following day, I managed to get up to get the lift to Charlie 43 Squadron. They'd gone to Philippeville, which was the next bay this way from Beaune. So we went up together. We managed to get lifts and get up to Beaune. Beaune, we had a hell of a time. They did, honestly. We were bombed during the night and shot at during the day. It was quite a hectic time, one way and another. My only kind of claim to fame, really, during this period, that I managed to shoot down a Focke-Wulf 190 with a Spitfire 5.
How did that happen?
We spotted them about 10,000 feet below, so we were going that fast they couldn't get away. And Rathbury got the other. We got two. And I think one was damaged as well. But the most interesting one, as far as I was concerned, this was telling the logbook the date, early January, we'd really had a rough passage. And Raz said, look, he said, I'll give you an easy do today. He said, we've got a new replacement pilot who's no operational experience. Will you take him to on a escorting an invasion barge coming back from having put down a radar station on it was just behind the enemy lines, and we were just escorting this barge back when it came over the RT that Ju-87s, Stukas, were bombing Bowen Harbour. I thought, this is great. You know, we were approaching Bowen Harbour at about 500 feet we were. They would be pulling out of their dive around about 1,000. Stukas can't shoot down. And I thought, this is the sort of odds I like. So we went into battle formation, took our safety catches off and went. And I'm coming up underneath a Stuka, open fire and hitting him, when my port wing from the cannon magazine backwards seemed to disappear. And I was convinced I'd been hit by a Bofors gun. I was, as I say, very low, and that's no time to do anything. The aeroplane just went like that down into the sand dune, fortunately landing on the good wing, which took all the force, and the ground was soft, and I was probably not knocked out for more than a couple of 2 or 3 minutes at the most. And this happened right in front of the airfield. If you imagine the dispersal, the airfield, some marshy ground, the sand dunes and the sea. And this had, everybody had witnessed this from the crew room. Or we were using as a crew room, it was an old tin shed. I was trying to get back as soon as to say what I thought of the British Army. An ambulance came to pick me up, but it couldn't get over the marshy ground. So I staggered over the marshy ground, carrying him by parachute, cursing the British Army, and eventually got back to the crew room. Whereas to complain to Raz, and he said, rubbish, you were shot down by 109. I said, 109? I never saw 109. He said, no, I know you didn't, but you were shot down by 109. And that goes in your logbook. And he put that bloody... There's a finger there, isn't there?
Yes.
He put that up.
It's drawn a hand.
A finger. Pull your finger out. You should have seen the 109. But now there's a sequel to that. About 2 years ago, I'm down at Southampton, and a friend of mine, a Spitfire Society friend of mine, was having a barbecue in his garden. Nothing to do with Spitfires or anything like that, it was just a family barbecue. And we were invited, and we were there, and I was sat with next to his next-door neighbour, a lady, old lady, lived next door. He said, I've got a photograph of you at home. I said, you can't have a photograph. I've never met the good woman in my life. Oh, she said, yes, I've got a photograph. My brother was in charge of the service in commando. And he's written a book. She said, I'll lend you a copy. So she went and got it. So I took it back. I was staying with my daughter that lived down there. And... the next day, I'm going through it, there's an incident, a bone. I took a photography of the part, and it was talking about one of the most tragic incidents he'd seen during the war, when a Spitfire was about to shoot down an enemy aircraft, and all the Beaufort's guns were told to cease fire, but they all did except one, who hit the Spitfire and not the enemy aircraft. Oh, this strikes a chord, you know. And so I rang her and I said, look, your brother, is he still alive? Oh, yes, he lives in Wolverhampton. She gave me his telephone number, so I rang him. And he said, well, I said, I remember the incident very well. But he said the relations between the Army and the Air Force were very strained, and it was decided that this mustn't be reported. And that's why you were shot down by a 109. So it was friendly fire that shot me down.
Do you think Raspberry knew that?
Oh, yes, he knew. Of course he did. Of course he did. I mean, there was no 109. They never saw 109. There wasn't one there. But I was... I should have seen it. well, then, of course...
Did you have any other successes against the enemy in North Africa?
Yeah, I got 4 and 2 probables, but details without the logbook, I can't really tell you. I can't remember much about it. It's a long time ago. And the interesting part, I got my DFM, I think it was promulgated in... I've got the thing in the dining room. February 1943. And then I found out some 2 or 3 months later that I had been commissioned in the field in January. And I was commissioned director flying officer, and I didn't find that out till after the war. I contracted yellow fever and ended up in a hospital, and I spent some time in hospital. And when I came out, I had to go to an air... I hadn't been flying for a month or two, and I was sent to an air experience flight, which was somewhere in the desert. They were getting up towards Sukalaba at the time. And I was... the flight commander said, well, your squadron have now got Spitfire 9s. And, of course, I knew we'd got Spitfire 9s because I was with them when we got this 9. He said, I have a Spitfire 9, you better have an hour or two on that. So, of course, I didn't feel that I was needed to go to an air experience flight. So I take a Spitfire 9 and get on the RT calling my squadron code, call sign. And they got a reply, and I got a vector to find. I think they were at Sukal Chemist, they were, and I landed at Sukal Chemist and asked somebody where 81 Squadron was, and they told me where they were, kind of tents were, which were they were using as crew rooms. And I'm walking towards this when the squadron adjutant drives past on a motorbike. And he stopped. He said, what the hell are you doing here? So I told him what had happened. And he said, what do you dress like that for? I said, why? He said, you were commissioned 2 months ago. And I didn't know. Nobody had told me. And he took me there, straight there to the stores and what have you, and kitted me out as an officer. And I saw Raspberry, and he was then the wing commander, and he said, right, you come back to the squadron tomorrow. You go and tell this chap at the Air Experience flight that I want you here, and if there's any arguments, to give me a ring. So I set off back in my Spitfire 9 to find where he was, and it started to go dark. It goes dark very rapidly, and I remember seeing an airstrip, so I turned around and put it down on this airstrip, which was an American base, flying Mitchells, I think they were flying. Anyway, they entertained me for the night, and the next morning I carried on and to to the place where this Spitfire 9, I can't remember the name of it now, this airstrip where the Spitfire 9 came from. And I always got what it was going to do, was going to court-martial me, this, that and the other. The strange thing was I'd kind of left there as a sergeant pilot and come back as a flying officer, and which shook him a little bit. And I said, I've got to go and join the squad. He said, I'll say when you go to the squad. And I said, will you ring the wing commander? He wants you to ring him. So I came back. He said, you've got to go today. So I went back to the squadron. The CO was then Colin Gray, a New Zealander, who since just died very recently. And a lot of the replacement pilots were New Zealanders. In fact, the 81 squadron virtually became a New Zealand squadron, particularly when Raz became group captain and Colin Gray was up to wing commander, and we all got a new New Zealand CO. All they wanted a New Zealand squadron. Anyway, after the fall of Tunis, we went to Malta for the Sicily landings, and I remember coming back from a fighter sweep over Sicily, landing, and the adjutant saying, look, you've 20 minutes to pack and catch transport, you're going back to UK, tour expired. Which, of course, you don't argue, you just dash, don't you? And we dashed, packed up quick, and they gave me transport. The aeroplane to going back to UK was from Lucca, so we dashed to Lucca on the last, very last minute, and there was about 12 pilots, including Laurie Frampton, the one I've given you address. Which aircraft is it? And there was a Dakota there, and that's the one. So we rushed and jumped in this Dakota and took off. And his daddy was flying south. I thought, this is odd. So somebody went up to the flight deck and said, where are we going? And he said, this is not the way to UK. And he said, I'm not going to UK, I'm going to Cairo. Oh, God, I said, we've got on the wrong aeroplane. So he said, I'm not going back, but I'll drop you off at Tripoli, Castel Bonito at Tripoli. So we landed there and we all got up. Now, what the hell do we do then? We go with no papers, with nothing to say. We were going back to UK. In fact, we're just 12 pilots on with nothing. So we talked about it. And eventually we knew that Eastern Air Command headquarters was Constantine. We'd make our way to Constantine and report to Eastern Air Command headquarters, see what happened. Which we did in Dribble. We got lifts in Dakotas to, we were billeted in a transit camp, a technical school at Constantine. We kept going up to Eastern Air Command headquarters and they kept saying, we haven't got any, nothing's come through, we can't get any information. And in fact, we were there 6 weeks. And in the basement of this technical tool was an American Forces radio had set up. And we had our own programme, the Legion of the Lost Airmen, and anybody could find it, we just broadcast for it. And we decided the best thing to do was to, we would organise a dance in this technical school, and we'd invite the air officer commanding and the people from, and the local nurses. And I've forgotten the name of the air officer commanding, but he did come. And the idea was we were going to ply him with scotch and then ask him what was happening. I've forgotten his name, but he flew with the Imperial Airways before the war. And it worked very well. In the end, we explained the position to him, and he said, look, you come down to Eastern Air Command tomorrow morning, bring your logbooks, and if you can prove to me that your tour expired, I will authorise you back to UK. And that's what happened. And we came back to UK. Well, we had to get a lift to Algiers and get a boat from Algiers. And then I came back to UK, joined 285 Squadron with Hurricanes and Oxford's Army Cooperation Squadron.
Where was this?
Originally at Woodvale.
Where's Woodvale?
Southport. And then I became a flight commander and took a flight to Fairwood Common, where I worked with the army on preparation for the Second Front, the invasion of the... and had some very interesting times with them, a very, very pleasant time.
What did army cooperation work consist of in those days?
Well, there was all sorts of things. There was graduating guns by flying aircraft on a dead steady course at a fixed height so they could graduate their guns. There was also ground attack work, getting them, you know, we would simulate ground attack on troops and this sort of thing. And it was quite an interesting job, really. I got quite friendly with the army altogether there.
How did you like it after the normal fighter work?
Well, it was a complete change. It was a rest. It was, it was a pleasant time, really. I did enjoy it, I must admit. I mean, there was no... Very rarely was there any question of any danger. And then it was considered operational, and I think it was in about Christmas 44...
44 or 43? 44.
I think I was with the. The powers that be decided all flying instructors were to be ex-operational pilots. I think they'd got so many two-tour people that had they didn't know what to do with. They decided this was to happen. So I was sent on to an instructor's course at Montrose. I think we started on, was it January 45? I think.
Well, carry on. The exact date doesn't matter
anyway. I know we resided at Montrose. I think it was on New Year's Day when everything was frozen up. There's no water supply or anything. Oh, it was awful for the first day or two, and you had to go out into the snow, and it was deep snow everywhere. And I went and learned to become a flying instructor. And that's where I met up with Frank Twitchett. He was also on this course. And we were paired together. So according to my logbook, I taught him to fly. And according to his log, he taught me to fly. You know. we eventually, at the end of the course, I was posted to 9 advanced... Pilot Advanced Flying Training Unit at Errol, where my wife was the Queen Bee, and we didn't get on very well at the time.
Why not?
Well, I didn't know much about flying instructing, as you will appreciate, but I was a flight lieutenant, and the flight lieutenants had to be flight commanders in those days, and I was given D flight. Which